Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture, by Vincent Woodard, edited by Justin A. Joyce and Dwight McBride. Foreword by E. Patrick Johnson. Narrated by Stan Brown. Foreword, E. Patrick Johnson. The Delectable Negro is a provocative reading of race relations vis-à-vis an almost indiscernible homoeroticism in the 19th century. According to Woodard, such homoeroticism was always already there, but our contemporary framing of homosexuality has obscured our vision. Moreover, he suggests that the absence of an appropriate linguistic apparatus, the dearth of historical documentation, and the lack of theoretical models with which to excavate homoeroticism from extant historical documents have all colluded to conceal the presence of this racialized libidinal dynamic. Shaman-like, Woodard sharpens our vision by immersing himself in the archive while relying on what Philip Bryan Harper calls the evidence of felt intuition. To reveal the unsaid and the taboo hidden in plain sight, what is perhaps more enlightening and frightening, however, is his framing of homoerotic desire and slavery through cannibalism. Woodard deploys cannibalism as more than just a metaphor, as he documents actual instances in slave and ex-slave narratives, autobiographies, and WPA interviews of whites' literal consumption of black flesh. Thus, instead of the question Du Bois frames as the most compelling problem facing the Negro in the 20th century, Woodard argues that another question was already on the forefront of the Negro's mind in the 19th century. How does it feel to be an edible, consumed object? The erotic charge catalyzed in the process of consumption, according to Woodard, was not unidirectional, but also emanated from black men toward white men and toward each other. Indeed, Woodard dares to speak of black men's sexual agency around their own libidinal desires and how those desires and acts were mobilized in the service of their own self-preservation from literal and spiritual consumption. In The Delectable Negro, Woodard convincingly analyzes the psychosexual details of consumption as it flowed both ways. The result is a fierce rethinking of the ways in which capitalism, racism, and sexuality functioned within a slave economy that framed the libidinal formation of race relations for generations. Vincent Woodard's thinking on this topic evolved over a 10-year period beginning in graduate school. I met him and heard him talk about this research for the first time in 1999 at the University of Texas at Austin, where I had been invited to perform and where he was a graduate student in English and American Studies. Like many self-actualized black gay academics, he understood the precariousness of the profession he had chosen and proceeded accordingly. That is to say, he understood the old adage, "You have to be twice as good," a mantra most black folks were taught growing up, as well as the fact that his gayness would be both a hindrance and an asset within the academy, depending on the context and how that identity marker would be consumed by his students, colleagues, and critical interlocutors. Working his way through graduate school at the height of queer theory and during the nascent stages of black queer studies meant that Woodard had to negotiate mastering the established feel of queer studies while also following in the footsteps of his peers and mentors who were waging a critique against queer theory's blind spots to race. In some ways, it was the best time to be in graduate school. to take advantage of the explosion of new work and to be a part of the theoretical and political conversations generated by scholars and activists committed to legitimizing sexuality studies in the academy. But in other ways, the late 1990s and the early 2000s were a challenging time for graduate students who sometimes were overwhelmed by the sheer volume and multiple twists and turns of this emerging scholarship and who sometimes felt trapped professionally and politically in a world where just the mere topic of their dissertation or who their advisor was could determine whether or not they were taken seriously as scholars or if they would be viable on the job market. Vincent and I discussed all of this and more over emails and visits during the early years of our friendship. Although he thought of me as a mentor as much as he did as a friend, it was always I who was impressed with the way his mind worked. I'll never forget, for example, the first time he discussed with me his ideas about writing about cannibalism and homoeroticism. At the time, there was nothing I could offer by way of feedback or encouragement, mainly because I thought it would be too intellectually ambitious to imbricate those two topics in the context of slavery. I became a believer, however, when Vincent sent me the first draft of his manuscript in 2005, then titled Recovering the Black Male Womb, Slavery, Homoeroticism and 19th Century Racial Uplift. I wrote notes and questions on just about every page because the ideas were so provocative. I was still unsure, however, if he would be able to successfully pull together everything that he wanted to say and justify all of the claims that he was making. The turning point came in 2006 at the American Studies Association conference in Oakland, California, where Vincent delivered a paper entitled Blood Magic and Sorcery in the State Formation Archive, in which he laid out what would become the key terms of delectable Negro as unearthed in the archive, consumption, hunger, homoeroticism, and slavery. It seemed the entire conference was abuzz with talk about Woodard's paper, and it would be the turning point for Woodard as he began to hone in on two topics that were too taboo for even the most courageous of academics, cannibalism and same-sex desire under slavery. For those who knew Vincent Woodard and understood his genius, the theorizing and analysis contained in the chapters of this book will come as no surprise. And for those who experience it for the first time, they will be in for a treat. Vincent knew how to tell a good story, and this one is his finest. And he knew it. That is why, in the final days of his life, he told his colleague, John Michael Rivera, at the University of Colorado Boulder, to make sure that this manuscript got to Dwight A. McBride and to me so that we could see that it got published. And that is what Dwight and I have worked toward for the past 5 years, with the assistance of Justin A. Joyce and a host of undergraduate and graduate research assistants. And quietly but persistently urging us on have been his parents, Vera and Cedric Woodard, who have waited patiently to see the fruits of their son's labor. I am still in denial about Vincent's passing because I feel his presence so viscerally. He was immediately recognizable as a genderqueer. That day in 1999 in Austin when we first met in a coffee shop, he strolled in wearing a sarong and flowing locks and exhibiting a bohemian confidence. We spent hours talking about poetry, politics, and black people. Many often mistook his soft-spoken demeanor as a sign of timidity, but soon discovered, as I did, that this could not have been further from the truth. On many occasions, I witnessed the lioness in Vincent emerge. Whether dealing with a waiter at a restaurant whose service was insulting or flinging a zinger at a scholar who was being obtuse or apolitical in their presentation, Vincent was deft and deliberate in delivering his thoughts about someone being trifling. What was so funny about these instances is that as soon as he had his say, the sweet, gentle, nonchalant Vincent would turn back to you and pick up where he left off in the conversation before the object of his wrath had so rudely interrupted him. Plainly, Vincent was a fierce diva, but only when it was necessary. He was centered both in who he was as a person and as an activist. This is probably because Vincent was such a spiritual person and praised the ancestors in every aspect of his life. Now that he has crossed over, his own spirit is traveling the universe, radiating the poetic goodness of his soul. Now he has left the delectable Negro as his legacy for us to consume. As we partake of it, may we think of Vincent, sashaying through our digestive tract, providing us with nutrients for the soul, but also giving us a little heartburn along the way. Nothing this good ever goes down easy, and Vincent wouldn't have it any other way. Introduction. Master eated me when I was meat. In the summer of 2007, I visited Somerset Place in Creswell, North Carolina. At one point, Somerset Place, a historically restored plantation, was the most successful plantation in North Carolina, and its owner, Josiah Collins III, one of the largest slaveholders in the state. It is now a state historic site sitting on over 100 acres of lush forest and wetland. My party and I arrived early one Saturday morning, parked near the overseer's quarters, and walked the red cobblestone road down the center of the plantation, past the stocks, past the smokehouse, past the outside cooking facilities, to the gift shop, where the tour begins. My travel companions browsed the bookstore while I sat in the adjoined seating area taking in the genealogy of enslaved persons who had formerly lived on the plantation. Someone had conveniently mounted photographs and biographies of these persons on the walls. There was Darius Bennett, a Somerset field hand who had heard the cannons signaling the Civil War. There was Betsy Sproul Riddick, seated with her hands folded before a wooden shack. There was even a makeshift family tree dating back to the first enslaved Africans to arrive on Somerset Plantation. After a while, all of us there for the morning tour made our way into the seating area where our tour guide finally came in and stood before us. He wore khaki pants, a maroon polo shirt, and glasses. He was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and stood about 6'3" tall. For the sake of discussion, I will refer to him as Mr. Swellfellow, because he had that look of a good hometown guy. He probably lived in the same neighborhood as his mother, if not with his mother, volunteered with the local fire department, had a high school sweetheart he was engaged to, went to church every Sunday, and, as far as I could see, wore honesty about his face like a child wears a milky mustache. He was totally disarming and chubby and southern and immediately attentive, standing before us, leaning on the mantle of the fireplace. After warming to us, he began talking about the pictures on the wall and quickly segued into minor details about the plantation. Not all of the original buildings had been restored to the plantation. This was a walking tour that would begin at the overseer's quarters and end at the big house. A woman who had once tried to escape was put into the stocks in the winter time. Her legs froze, and they had to be amputated. Each month, enslaved adults received a ration of a peck of corn and 3 pounds of dried meat. The slaves on this plantation were well fed, Mr. Swellfellow emphasized, before rattling off more details about the tour. I tried to stay focused, but my mind returned to the rationed meat and cornmeal, the fact that hard field labor would have depleted such rations in a week, and the image of happy, well-fed darkies ever so casually introduced into Mr. Swellfellow's presentation. I raised my hand and waited for Mr. Swellfellow to call on me. True to his namesake, Mr. Swellfellow noticed my hand and welcomed my question. "Mr. Swellfellow," I began, "I want to go back to an earlier point you made for clarification. You said that the enslaved were given a peck of corn and 3 pounds of meat, and then you said that they were well fed. But, to my thinking, the enslaved must have gone hungry, especially those working in the fields, who would have needed more substance than this to sustain them in back-breaking, day-long labor." The smile on Mr. Swellfellow's face dimmed a little, even as he formulated an entirely hopeful response. "The slaves were well fed," he insisted. "It was not in the economic interest of the master to starve them, and besides, the Collinses were kind and had benevolent relations with their slaves. They weren't the type to make their slaves go hungry." "Actually, Mr. Swellfellow," I interrupted, "it was in the economic interest of slave masters to starve their slaves. This fact is well documented in literature written by fugitive slaves. And on the subject of kindness, the so-called kindness of masters hardly ever, to my knowledge, interfered with their profit motive. What better way to profit than by giving your slaves minimal nourishment while you expect, in return for investment, maximum labor output?" Only after I stopped speaking did I realize I was shaking internally and had taken an edge to my voice. I became aware of my African-American travel companion sitting across the room and the few other white tourists who were part of our morning party. Mr. Swellfellow had flushed and begun to sweat. He had become anxious and nervous. Clearly, his National Park Service tour guide training had not prepared him to deal in a knowledgeable manner with questions of hunger and starvation on the plantation. Perhaps, too, he felt embarrassed. Embarrassed at his immediately defensive posture. Embarrassed at his rushing to defend the master. And, finally, embarrassed and angry at my daring to challenge what was clearly a sacred memory, contented, well-fed blacks roaming about the plantation. Needless to say, this initial interaction with Mr. Swellfellow set the tone for the remainder of the tour. When, during the walking tour, he brought up the subject of enslaved persons stealing meat from the smokehouse, I responded by asking why such well-fed persons would have provocation to steal meat in the first place. At one point, thoroughly frustrated with the constant reinforcement of the pastoral and goodly nature of life on Somerset Plantation, I said to our tour guide so that everyone could hear, "Mr. Swellfellow, it seems to me that you and the state of North Carolina are invested in an image of the masters as goodly, and that you're not willing to entertain perspectives of plantation life that go against this reality." Swellfellow, sweating even more profusely, denied my accusations and did his best to avoid me the remainder of the tour. The history of slavery continues to have meaning in the 20th century. It burdens all of American history and is incorporated into public interpretations of the past, write James Oliver Horton and Lois E. Horton. We need only look as far as Somerset Place for an example of a historically laden and contested site of slave memory. There, we see the circumstances of slave existence and the meaning of the master's authority and goodwill as fluid, contested categories of experience regulated by the state and a larger master narrative of slave history. Similar issues regarding the meaning and import of slavery have affected contemporary battlefields and Civil War sites operated by the National Parks Service. As a result of pressure from Civil War heritage interest groups, those who give tours at these sites do not speak of slavery as the major social phenomenon that catalyzed the Civil War. In higher education, another state-regulated realm, the history of slavery continues to shape our lives. A good example of this is Brown University. Brown, like a number of universities on the East Coast, has ties to slavery that trace back to its founder, John Brown, members of Brown's educational community who have attempted to reconcile the university's historic and economic ties with the institution of slavery, have, in the process, encountered staunch resistance from the regents and alumni, among other constituencies. From contemporary debates over national identity to concerns about modern civil rights, the legacy of slavery continues to inform and impact our sense of civic belonging and investment in this experiment called the United States. Living, as we do, in a society in which many still deny the fundamental tie between the Civil War and slavery, helps me better understand, on a systemic level, Mr. Swellfellow's resistance to my insinuations of institutionalized hunger on the Somerset plantation. An admission of institutionalized hunger on the plantation would have required Mr. Swellfellow to alter his notions of the goodly, altruistic master. As well, such an allowance would have required that Mr. Swellfellow consider how sentimental conventions, Christian morals and values, Southern state formation and statecraft all informed our discussion of slaves made to hunger on the plantation. While Mr. Swellfellow had his own geographically bounded, he was from the surrounding area, and personal reasons for denying the existence of slave hunger, my insistence upon the topic arose mostly from the researching for and writing of this book. I had come to know through my research that instances of hunger, within such a pristine, well-kept context, were often only indicators of a much larger culture of institutionalized hunger. I had encountered numerous masters like Somerset's Josiah Collins III, who one biographer described as an autocrat with a will as imperious and a sway as absolute as the Tsar himself. Josiah III, I would find out months after my plantation tour, fit the profile of the cultivated, overlording type of master who used hunger and all manner of social conditioning to wring from enslaved people maximum labor and to instill in these persons fear and self-denial. Hunger, with persons such as Collins, was often only the tip of the iceberg. So much more than hunger was at stake in my interactions with Mr. Swellfellow. If he and I could not talk about hunger on the plantation, then we would never, as individuals or a nation, be able to talk about other intersecting issues such as social consumption, ritualized hunger, or cannibalistic masters populating southern plantations such as Somerset Place. For my part, my encounters at Somerset Place disturbed me and catalyzed in me a state of personal and intellectual reflection. Was the nation, not to mention the state of North Carolina, ready for an open and inquiring discussion into the topics of hunger and human consumption on the plantation? Was I ready to and capable of serving as mediator of this discussion, which clearly had a life beyond the book pages I had labored to fill over the years? In the 19th century, none but the most radical abolitionists believed the enslaved persons' claims about consuming masters and their descriptions of a culture of human consumption pervading plantation life. Over a century later, not much had changed. Not only had we collectively forgotten many of the significant details of slavery that continue to impact the present, but we had also willed ourselves to forget the horrific forms that human hunger and the pursuit of power could take. Despite our will to forget and desire to reconfigure the past, the reality is that institutionalized hunger and practices of human consumption characterized life on many southern plantations. No topic disturbed and mystified 19th century America like the subject of human consumption under slavery. For the most part, whites, during the time, responded to this topic, as did Mr. Swellfellow, with an air of secrecy and shame. For example, one of the most notorious incidents of literal black consumption from the 19th century involved members of the whaling ship Essex, which sailed from Nantucket, Massachusetts, in 1838. White Nantucketers still today have little to say about the incident, especially the fact that the first four crew members to be murdered and eaten by whites were black. Nantucket was known in the 19th century as a Quaker and abolitionist stronghold, and its residents then and still today find it hard to explain ship captains operating as slave drivers, African persons treated in a brutish manner aboard whaling ships, and more pointedly, the master-slave ideology informing the consumption of the four black men. Colonial-era Nantucketers were not alone in their self-preserving silence. Slave-owning whites, for different reasons, covered up the reality of black consumption. Take, for example, the circumstances surrounding the consumption of Nat Turner, the black insurrectionist. Black members of the Southampton, Virginia community left oral records of whites who tried to coerce them into consuming Nat Turner's boiled-down flesh and entrails. Black persons also implied that 19th-century whites might have consumed the revolutionary as a medicinal substance. Whites from the time period dismissed such ideas as folk belief, arising from the backward and infantile culture of older darkies. To add to this, scholars of Turner's experience have, on the whole, denied, infantilized, or dismissed the observation of black persons. These scholars, it seems, are not aware of those aspects of U.S. plantation culture that were based in parasitism and a dynamic of human consumption. In Slavery and Social Death, A Comparative Study, Orlando Patterson describes slavery as a parasitic institution that white masters strove to conceal in ideology and act. According to Patterson, the slaveholder, in order to maintain an image of himself as civilized and free of parasitic appetites, camouflaged his dependence, his parasitism, by various ideological strategies. Paradoxically, he defined the slave as dependent. This is consistent with the human technique of camouflaging a relation by defining it as the opposite of what it really is. Parasite is the perfect concept for my purposes, as it implies a range of consumptive acts, some resulting in immediate death, but most involving the passage of time and the incremental feeding upon the human host. Most of my examples of consumption on and off the plantation range from the literal murder and eating of black persons to what we might think of as metaphoric acts. I refer to these metaphoric acts, which encompass starving, flesh seasoning rituals, and sexual modes of consumption, variously as consumption, human consumption, metaphoric consumption, instances of social consumption, and even cannibalism. I will explain the historical and contemporary significance of such terms as cannibal later in the introduction, but I wanted to acknowledge here that I do use a range of terms to describe instances of consumption. My cluster of terms challenges the layers of stereotype and imprecise language that have historically characterized the topic of the consumption of slaves. As a common strategy, masters often hid their appetites and hungers in stereotypes and ideologies that attributed these characteristics to the slaves. Patterson describes a reality wherein the master deflected his appetites and hungers onto myths of the chattel slave as dependent, childlike, and somehow ennobled by the master's consumptive needs. In dismissing the bonded person's accusations of consumption as infantile rants, which I point out using Turner's example, scholars have reinforced this slave-owning ruling class mentality and have helped to maintain a general code of silence regarding the master's appetites and sycophantic needs. This pattern of silencing has resulted in the dismissal of the reality of those enslaved persons who frequently described slavery as an outgrowth of the master's homoerotic and consumptive appetites. Within U.S. slavery, black men and women consistently described incidents of human consumption that occurred on literal, metaphoric, and institutional levels of social interaction. These incidents often had a homoerotic or sexual charge to them. John S. Jacobs.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?